Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, how about day 10 of the 2021 Australian Open? I hope this isn't too hyperbolous, but a truly, I think, historic day in Grand Slam and Australian Open history. Talk about going out on a high for Button Man with the fake crowd controls. He's out of a job tomorrow, not because he's had a shocker of a few days, but because crowds will be returning to Melbourne Park from Thursday, which is just such a wonderful thought. And it's a doubly wonderful thought that after the day that we've had today, and we're going to spend an hour waxing lyrical about it, that there's still a way for tomorrow to be better. There's not that feeling of, oh, it's over. I still feel like, wow, tomorrow is kind of guaranteed to be different, but wonderful.
Yeah. And just enriched by having people there, no matter what, isn't it? Should say, overnight, we had the breaking news that it isn't a person operating the fake crowd.
Do we trust this breaking news? Are you sure? I don't trust any of your breaking news anymore, David, after...
That hurts.
After...
Is it run by a poll?
After yesterday, we didn't even have time to come on to this yesterday, but David started rumours of a win predictor scandal by breaking the news on the BBC, so I took it to be gospel, that the win predictor, which you'll see at various points in matches flashed up on the screen in graphics, was not in fact based on a complicated and finely tuned algorithm, but in fact based on the world's biggest pole vault.
This information had come to me by somebody who worked for ABC in Australia, so it must have been true.
Equivalent to the BBC.
Yeah.
This is a lot of misinformation being spread by supposedly reputable sources.
Sorry, everybody.
Anyway, David started a big pole vault rumour and it turned out to be bollocks.
Yes, basically something like the Game Insight group or something like that got in touch on Twitter to tell us that it was all hard numbers mashed together to produce a win predictor scale of many for one player and however many for the other player.
Yeah, and to be fair, Game Insight group, we understand, do some absolutely terrific work. I have to say, I don't think their match predictor is their finest work. I think that's why we believed it could be a pole vault of random people.
Pole vault's great, folks.
Yeah, not anybody's finest work ever, a pole. My brother informs me that the Game Insight group are sort of the gold standard of data analysis in tennis, and he's not easily pleased on the data analysis front. So I totally take his word that they do better work than the win predictor might suggest, because it isn't always a thing of beauty or even sophistication.
Mm. So it's a bit like how I'm sure I do better work than pole vault, but you know, I'm still getting behind it.
I would say some of its finest work that I've witnessed might have come during the truly epic Stefanos Tsitsipas-Rafael Nadal match, which finished what, half an hour ago, something like that. Because it showed the percentage chances of win, respective wins before the match, and then it showed the swing into the fifth set. And there'd been a 26% swing in Tsitsipas's favour. And I think midway through the fifth set, at which point we were all speculating among ourselves on WhatsApp, and David was instructing Hannah on Twitter to do a poll, and I tried to put the kibosh on that, but I got there too late and David had already done it. We were all speculating who was the favourite at that stage, and we all had a different answer. Well, the win predictor had Tsitsipas at 54% and Nadal at 46%. So today's big winner was the win predictor.
Hold on, I said he would win as well that fifth set.
So did I.
Well, there you go.
I wasn't going to say that, David.
So today's big loser was me and Rafael Nadal.
Yes, but you had good reason to back the 20-time Grand Slam champion, Matt, in that situation. Perhaps we should talk about how he and we all came to be in that situation. The preceding 3.5 hours of tennis that got us to that point, that got us to the point of Stefanos Tsitsipas beating Rafael Nadal from 2 sets to love down. The second time anyone has done that in Grand Slam history. Fabio Fognini did it to him at the US Open in 2015, but that result comes with the asterisk of it being Nadal in 2015, which was the weakest Nadal that we've seen at any point in his career. It's been done a third time by Roger Federer in the Miami final in 2005, but that was 2005, at which stage he hadn't won a single Grand Slam. So this is historic. This is an historic victory for Stefanos Tsitsipas, and all the more so because of how the first 2 sets panned out. What chance, David, were you giving Tsitsipas of winning that match? What would your win predictor have been for Tsitsipas after those first 2 sets? Won by Nadal 6-2, 6-3?
6-3,
6-2.
6-3, 6-2. Yeah.
And probably even less close than that scoreline.
Yeah.
Suggested. They reminded me of Nadal against Federer at the French Open in sort of the late noughties, early 2010s, of just bereft.
Well, it reminded
nothing
me
to
of,
do. The matchup just doesn't work.
It reminded me of Tsitsipas against Nadal 2 years ago in the same round. He won 6 games in the whole match, Tsitsipas, that day. And very similar. And I thought, the matchup is all wrong for him. He looks bereft. He looks impotent, really, in the face of what he's up against. Nadal was playing brilliantly, I thought. His tactics were perfect. He was hooking the forehand into the backhand of Tsitsipas. And as you rightly say, it was Roger Federer 12 years worth on display in those first 2 sets before Federer finally cracked it in 2017 and beyond. And my sense was that, I mean, you asked me a percentage, I'd have given him 10% chance, probably, if that.
I think that's generous.
Maybe it is, yeah.
Matt, what would you have given it just at that stage?
Yeah, 5, 10%, something like that. Nadal doesn't lose leads like that, and he's playing it so well, and Tsitsipas can't figure him out. Everything was on Nadal's side.
My sense was that Tsitsipas had come out with a premeditated strategy, and I mean, you should come out with a strategy. I felt like he'd almost watched Roger Federer 2017 back and thought, right, I'm going to rip my backhand and he's going to have it. And he tried to do it from ball one, and either Nadal just stepped around it and dismissed it down the line for a clean winner, or kept him camped in that corner. He was making no impact at all. And I also thought, he hadn't played himself in before he was trying to go for his shots and Tsitsipas, and he just hadn't got the timing. He wasn't feeling the ball. And I thought, I mean, it was ugly. It was a non-event. And I wrote to you both that it's dispiriting to watch this because I was really looking forward to it. And I sensed that what happened was in the third set, he stopped trying to stick to whatever blueprint they'd come up with, and he just played. And he just tried to feel his way in, play each ball on its merits, back his own ability with the racket and his own physicality to try to stay with Nadal. And Nadal went off the boil dramatically. And it was really the two missed smashes that Nadal hit that made you really kind of look at him as if, is that, am I seeing that right? Because I don't remember seeing Nadal miss smashes.
Two in a game, albeit a tiebreak.
Well, a tiebreak, yeah.
I don't think that's ever happened before. Nadal does not miss overheads.
Mm-hmm. And he also missed a very easy forehand in that tiebreak. I mean, we were so close to talking about a Nadal destruction of Tsitsipas here. I mean, even in that third set, Tsitsipas was playing better for sure. He was holding his serve. He didn't come close to winning points on Nadal's serve in that third set. Mm. I think he won one before the tiebreak.
I know Nadal was 20 for 20 at one point.
He was making Nadal, who on his best day, his serve isn't his forte. Look, he's maximised it and worked on it so hard over the course of his career and made it, if not quite one of his best weapons, but absolutely not a weakness. But bearing in mind, Nadal came into this tournament with a injury that was forcing him to adjust his service motion 20 years into his career. He looked like Ivo Karlovic for three sets. And what the stats looked like Ivo Karlovic for three sets.
Yeah. So the way that just a few points transform this match from one thing into something completely different was fascinating. Because as soon as Nadal lost that tiebreak, the match felt different to watch. Tsitsipas had grown. He had belief. And Nadal's game didn't desert him. He still played okay in the fourth and fifth sets, but he was nowhere near as good as he was at the start. And Tsitsipas was so much better. And I find that fascinating, how just a little moment like that can completely turn a match. It's wonderful.
I can't believe I'm about to ask this question, but was Nadal tired?
I think he, in sets four and five, he looked tired to me. He was sweating buckets. And
as he left the court at the end, now I know it was a long match and grueling mentally and physically, but he looked kind of a shot. And I know he always sweats buckets, but kind of as red in the face as I've ever seen him. And I was starting to analyse whether the unforced errors were actually because his feet just minutely weren't quite in the right position as they normally would be.
He cramped in his press conference.
Oh, wow.
And he said he didn't feel fantastic in the fifth set, but he didn't feel bad either. He was very quick to give the credit to Tsitsipas for raising his game. He did talk about the regrets he had in that tiebreak. That was the moment where the match slipped from his grasp, I think, because then it did feel like Tsitsipas was the one bossing the rallies and the one playing it on his terms a little bit more. I think the conditions slowed down as the night went on. I think the first couple of sets, Nadal's ball was reacting off that surface and jumping up, and it was vicious to play against, whereas it seemed like he had less and less impact as the match went on. And perhaps that was a little bit of his own fatigue. Perhaps that was the conditions. And Tsitsipas started to take over.
It was great seeing Tsitsipas get out of his own head and just play on instinct, because I felt like I was watching an existential crisis for two sets, to the extent that it kind of impaired my enjoyment of how brilliant Nadal was being. And I wanted to try and enjoy that. But as you said, David, it was, you were kind of wincing at it. I was feeling all of his angst with him.
And the danger is that that could perpetuate, because if that keeps happening, how do you ever remove that scar tissue from your senses when it matters in the future? At some point, you have to break through the shackles of your own doubt and your own fear and your own intimidation, which is what I think he was suffering from in the rivalry and the matchup, the patterns of the rallies and all the rest of it. The fact that his own game was having no effect on his opponent. But he wins the third set. I thought Nadal looked like Federer against Milman at the US Open. He looked old. He looked sweaty, tired. Look, it doesn't mean anything. I mean, Nadal will come out and he'll be what he always is again. Of course he will, I believe. But in that moment, that's the visual I got, the similar feel. And it reminded me in the start of the fourth set when I saw him like that. I remembered him when he played Fanini the other day. He was asked about the conditions and he said, you know, my next match I think will be at night. I would prefer it I prefer the day because it's faster, it's quicker through the air. And I did just sort of note that mentally a little bit at the time, because those conditions he prefers. And yeah, he didn't look that comfortable as the match wore on, but it was just watching the shift. It was almost like the wind predictor visualized the shift in how things were going, if anything, because suddenly in neutral, in rallying balls, Tsitsipas is comfortable. And again, just backing his own movement and his own shot making, and then realizing, just growing before your eyes. I mean, this guy is his Everest, the ultimate challenge in the sport for him. And he climbed the mountain. And I thought it was... yeah, I mean, I feel bad for Nadal and the great story that is lost, but it's also uplifting to see a guy overcome all of this, all of these doubts.
Mm. How many times do you think commentators around the world said the name Borna Coric when match points were disappearing from Tsitsipas in that final game? I feel like probably quite a lot. And yet Nadal had played them so well, those match points. It didn't feel like Tsitsipas had lost them in the way he did against Coric. Just another kind of example of him growing and learning. And I think the other match to pick up on from the past is one that you picked up on, David, just in that third set, which was the Djokovic match at the French Open, where Tsitsipas had lost the first two sets by exactly the same scoreline. He then found a way to win the third set, gave him a foothold in the match, took it to a fifth, but was just beaten in the end by Djokovic. Well, today he's managed to sort of build on that experience.
Mm. And that's what where my 10% came from, if anything, is just the knowledge. At least he's been down two sets to love and disappointing before against one of the big three and found a way to be competitive. But his perseverance in set three was as important as his shot making and everything else later on.
Yeah.
And I should have given that comparison at the time, David, more credence, I think, because when you said that, I thought, sort of good point in theory, but in Tsitsipas's mind, it's not the big three. It's Nadal and the other two.
Yeah, I do agree with that. I mean, he had definitely, in his mind, he has elevated Nadal more than everybody else has, which seems impossible to do because we all revere Nadal. But we do tend to, I think mostly we tend to revere them as a trio. He has a different view.
Mm. Obviously, it turned out to be an amazing comparison. But also at the time, I was thinking, well, he had chances against Djokovic in those first two sets in Paris. I remember he just wasn't taking his break points. He wasn't getting close to Nadal in those first two sets today. So the fact that he, as you said, kept it together in that third set and built some belief up by holding his serve gave him the foundation, as you said, for his shot making to flourish later on. It was, yeah, remarkable.
He said in the post-match interview, "I'm speechless. I have no words to describe what just happened. I started very nervous, I won't lie, but I don't know what happened after the third set. The emotions are now undescribable."
Didn't he say, "I finished like a little bird"?
He said he flew like a bird.
He flew like a little bird. He likened himself to a lion in the second round, I think. The Kokkinakis win, that was, wasn't it? And he's likened himself to a bird today. I'd have actually gone lion today, but whatever. He felt like a little bird. And he was dressed like one. So that works. And then he said, "I give a big part of my win to being consistent with my mood." And he was actually. I don't know whether he was internally, but there were fewer remonstrations than there would usually be. You know, he wasn't behaving like a teenager towards his dad.
No, actually you're right. And I feel like they've arrived at a comfortable period in their relationship as coach, player, father, son. I mean, the emotion of the two of them when they hugged at the end. Oh
God, it was like when they hug in Good Will Hunting, isn't it? Oh God, it's like 3 hours of film building up to that moment.
Yes.
He got a coaching violation, didn't he? Tsitsipas, yeah. For Apostolos's input.
Yeah, I think Nadal thought he was getting a time violation at that moment.
Yes.
He looked up as if to say, damn you. Oh, no, it's not for
me. It was like violation bingo. he wrote on the camera, TP, that's for you, which we are taking as a endorsement and nod towards the tennis podcast. The case is not yet closed.
Very much up in the air.
Yes, yes. Will we ever know? Maybe not. Nadal said after the match in the press conference, "Of course, I'm sad. I lost a match in the quarterfinals in an event that means a lot to me. I missed an opportunity to be in the semifinals again. Well done for him. He played better than me in the important moments. Was an equal match. I tried my best. At least I'm going home healthier than I was 1.5 weeks ago, which is a very positive thing for me." Just on the evenness of the match, there were 3 points that separated them in the end. How often is that the case in tennis? Just this beautiful scoring system. And both had more winners than unforced errors. You know, it wasn't just a match that was brilliant because of the drama and the undulations of it. The quality of it was also brilliant. They weren't necessarily both brilliant at the same time, but it was a high quality and thrilling match.
Yeah.
And credit to whatever digital divine device was controlling the crowd noise during the match, because I thought it did a pretty good job of filling some gaps, as did the seagulls. They were quite prominent.
I hope they were real. They were awesome.
There was a moment when I was only listening to a moment in the fourth set, David, when I was only listening to it on the radio with your commentary. And I did wonder, are they piping in seagull noise?
Like at the Masters golf.
Yeah.
The seagulls were loving it. I mean, they were pumped.
Yeah. Yeah, they were David Law-esque pumped.
Excellent.
And spoiler alert for a little bit later in the podcast, this wasn't even the biggest swing in momentum or turnaround in a match in the day, in my view. There was a bigger one.
No, there was. Just to finish on this briefly, because historically this is a massive moment, really. First of all, the fact that Nadal doesn't overtake at this tournament Roger Federer on 20 Grand Slam titles. They share that until at least the French Open in a few months' time. Djokovic now has a chance to close the gap. He's on 17. And it's just been tweeted by the ATP that with Nadal's loss, Djokovic will celebrate his 311th week as world number one on the 8th of March, passing Roger Federer for the all-time record.
Oh, that's huge, I think, for Djokovic.
There are two records that Novak Djokovic has constantly talked about wanting to have, and it's the men's Grand Slam record and it's the men's most weeks at world number one record. Yeah, that is huge for him. Incidentally, I think Nadal going out makes it worse for Djokovic this tournament. I think Tsitsipas or Medvedev would be tougher opponents for him in the final than Nadal, given his record against Nadal on a hard court.
That goes against everything David said yesterday and his big bigging up of the Nadal-Serena double.
Well,
but that is all very much a thing of the past. Or
easy to say that when he's out.
Well, yeah.
but I mean,
I think I did mention that yesterday as well.
I mean, look, Tsitsipas or Nadal on paper. I mean, look, I know what you're saying, but if Nadal had gone and crunched Tsitsipas in that third set, would you have been saying that? Would you have been saying that Medvedev's more of a risk than Djokovic than Nadal?
Yes, I would. I had Medvedev beating Nadal. I think.
If he'd have finished it off, he'd have won that third set 6-2.
It's the matchup.
Yeah.
He was winning set 6-2 against great players 2 years ago and got crunched by Djokovic. I know Djokovic isn't seemingly playing quite as well, but the stats are pretty stark. Nadal against Djokovic on a hard court.
It's like 18 in a row or something, David.
Like with That's For You, TP, we'll never know. the beauty of sport and sliding doors moments.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, tennis podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
It'll be Tsitsipas against Medvedev in the semi-finals, which we've kind of given away. Medvedev beat Rublev 7-5, 6-3, 6-2. I didn't watch that. I stayed up for the Barty Mukova match and then went to sleep. I saw the early stages actually of Brady and Pegula. I trusted David that you would wake up well before your alarm.
I was there.
Have this one covered. Yeah. I love Rublev. I've got a lot of time for his game, but I wasn't remotely surprised by the scoreline, that it was very one-sided for Medvedev. There's just more to his game at the moment.
The thing was, it wasn't even that one-sided. It was very competitive, and yet it was straight sets, which is even to me is even more alarming for Rublev, because I thought he played quite well. I think he came out with a slightly different strategy. He decided to just target the Medvedev forehand, and he was slamming his own forehand. But he can't hit through him. Everybody keeps going on about what a massive forehand Rublev's got. He can't finish points against this guy. And, you know, it was close in the first set, 7-5. Second set, they had a 43-stroke rally that Rublev managed to win, but it finished him. I think he got to break point in the next game, but it was so brief. It was just, he was on fumes at that point. And looking at him, I was worried for him. It was very hot, and he was in a slugfest with a guy he'd never taken a set from. And, I mean, I just really felt sorry for him, because I'm looking at him, and maybe he will do a Tsitsipas against Nadal. But I'm looking at that matchup and thinking, if Medvedev's dialed in, I don't see how you beat the guy.
It was before the tournament when Medvedev said he looks at the big three and he says that players are intimidated to take to the court against them physically and mentally. And he wants to get to that position. And it strikes me that he achieved that today against Rublev. He was buzzing off the fact that he made Rublev cramp. He said as much. He said, nobody does that to Rublev.
You sound like a psychopath.
Well, but I mean, that's the sport, isn't it? I mean, he's a great mate of his, and yet the sportsman in him, yeah. I mean, I agree with you. It's a badge of honor to beat the guy physically to that degree.
Mm. And I enjoyed this match because it made it so obvious what Medvedev's strengths are. I think sometimes Medvedev can be difficult to pin down as a tennis player, and that is intriguing as well. But today, the way, as David said, he just absorbed all the pace that Rublev was throwing at him and turned it back on him was kind of masterful. He made it look easy, really. He handled anything Rublev threw at him easily. I mean, it was a close match. There were lots of, it was grueling, it was physical, but just always felt like Medvedev was levels above.
So how'd you beat Medvedev then?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting one, isn't it, with Tsitsipas. If he plays his best, what happens? Can he do it? I think he can. I don't necessarily think he will, and I'm not sure what I'm going to pick for it yet. I mean, I would probably go for Tsitsipas because I did pick that at the start of the tournament. I had Tsitsipas beating Medvedev in the semifinals. Watching them, I mean, Medvedev does look awesome. He does, and he's got a handsome winning record against him. But Tsitsipas has just got a little bit of X factor about him as well. I feel like he's capable of exploding into some form that and difference, you know, that maybe the others can't handle.
All other things being equal, are you concerned for Tsitsipas's physicality, his ability to recover from today?
No.
Matt?
No, not particularly. It was a physical match for sure, but what was it, just over 4 hours? He didn't play the round before. I think he's got quite a lot in the tank. He's young, he's fit. I think he'll be all right physically. Yeah.
He's flying like a little bird. he'll be just fine. So Tsitsipas Medvedev is the semi-final.
What do you two think?
I still think Medvedev.
Yeah, I do.
Pre-tournament, I had Medvedev beating Djokovic in the final. And I don't feel confident about that at all. But I've not seen anything to change my conviction in that over the course of the last 10 days. Conviction is far too strong a word. Vague, unscientific feeling in the water. So I'll stick with that. But I'm pumped for Tsitsipas Medvedev.
Imagine what I'm like.
He is just beaming. How long have you both been up for? It's 2:09 PM now.
12
You're both
hours.
Indicating that you watched Rublev Medvedev. Did you watch Pegula Brady?
Yeah,
I woke up, David, when Pegula had just taken the first set.
Matt?
Well, I woke up at the start of the third set of Ash Barty.
Oh, yes. And
go
we
on,
had
Matt.
Quite the text exchange because there was so very much to fill you in on. I put out an appeal midway through the second set of that, sort of saying, oh, my God, someone wake up and share this with me because I sort of can't contain my thoughts about what's happening. I've been having a crisis about how on earth to explain the Ash Barty Carolina Mukova match on this podcast for the last 12 hours. I'm not sure, you know, Tsitsipas style, I'm not sure there are words.
Well,
I need your help because I didn't see it.
Tsitsipas said he was speechless and then spoke for about
and then
5 minutes uninterrupted.
Well, look, I thought it was one of the weirdest tennis matches I've ever seen. World number one, Ash Barty. I know she's not played for the past year prior to the Gippsland Great Open Road Ocean Tournament Trophy last week and this Grand Slam. But she's the world number one. She's, barring a couple of games here and there, looked in absolutely supreme form. She's got this incredible level head where nothing seems to faze her. She is absolutely cruising against Carolina Mukova, who looks bamboozled by the whole experience. There was no evidence of a specific injury, but she did look dazed. And it was hard to tell whether she was just dazed by what was coming at her from the other end of the court and this whole experience of, okay, it's her second Grand Slam quarterfinal, but you know, it's all still pretty new to her. And just the weight of shot coming from Ash Barty looked like it was knocking her off her feet. She was dazed and confused. She lost the first set 6-1. She hit 13 unforced errors in that set. And honestly, it felt less close than 6-1. It felt so uncomfortable to watch. It was embarrassing and it was car crash watching.
Oh, I kind of want to go back and watch it. Was it Mook, and where would you put the balance between one being great and the other one being terrible?
I mean, yes, the 13 unforced errors, that sounds bad, but it was also just her weapons were being made fun of by Barty. There were a couple of points, I think, in the second game on Mukova's serve where she hit her slice, which I've previously admired. I really liked the Mukova slice and the Mukova variety. And Barty just hit clean forehand winners off it. And it was like she was laughing in the face of weapons that had done damage against all her previous opponents. And I just thought, uh-oh. I was texting Andrew, American Andrew, who was covering our Twitter at the time, just sort of... reaching around for someone to share the experience with. Little did I know what was to come. And Andrew said, name me a thing that Mukova does better than Barty. And I thought about it for a long time and I replied, cry maybe at the end of this match.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
Andrew being our affectionate name for him, Andrew Bridges.
Yes. Hello, Andrew.
Bless him.
And the second set starts in the same way. Mukova gets broken. She's trailing 2-1. It feels there's no shift at the end of that set. It feels like a continuation of the first. Then Mukova calls for the doctor and the trainer to come onto the court. As I said, there wasn't evidence of a specific injury, she did look. There was no sort of fight. There was no. There were no remonstrations at all. There was no sort of outward anything from Mukova. She did look just in a daze. So she goes off court from medical timeout. The total pause in play is probably about 6 or 7 minutes. It is quite lengthy. And play resumes. And then it got so weird that I'm at a bit of a loss. At this point, almost simultaneously to play resuming, Andrew highlighted on our Twitter that an erroneous graphic had been put out in the coverage of the Penguin...
Phillip Island Trophy.
Showing that Petra Martic was about to take on Ivo Karlovic for a place in the quarterfinals. And honestly, that match might have been less weird than the remainder of Mukova against Barty.
Because why?
Ash Barty couldn't find the tennis court for the remainder of that match. Prior to the medical timeout, Mukova had one winner in 10 games. Then she had 4 in the 2 games after it. She won 7 of the next 8 games after the medical timeout. And you're just waiting for her to steady that. You're thinking, okay, Banash Barty is going to have a moment where she releases some emotion or resets in some ways and she's going to find it again. She is the world number one. She knows how to play tennis. She's going to remember any minute now. It's not like there's a crowd here to get on her back and mount the pressure on in a way that I think happened a little bit against Kenin last year.
Just that kind of murmuring, nervous murmuring of, oh,
exactly.
What's happening?
And
what's
in fact, the what I thought was the DJ at the time seemed to find a new button for sort of nervous, confused crowd murmur.
Oh, God.
Especially for that match. You know that sort of just low-level hum that goes around the place, yeah, of like, well, we can't sort of cheer because this is awful, but I need to make some sort of noise. He started doing that and it was actually really, really appropriate. Sort of just this low-level chatter. And it never came. Mukova went to a double breakup in the third set. And when she was serving for the match with the double break cushion, there were breakback points for Barty. And I was thinking, if she gets broken back here, that's it. Because that will be an indicator that Barty has remembered how to play tennis, remembered that she's the world number one, and she'll resume what she was doing in the first set and normal service will be resumed. But she didn't. She just had a couple of moments and then she faded off the Rod Laver Arena. And it is a seriously worrying collapse from Ash Barty. I know some people are using it as a springboard to discuss the medical timeout. Pam Shriver tweeted, the medical timeout by Mukova at 1-6, 1-2 down, a breakdown in the second seemed legit, but it still does not sit well when it pivots a match on a dime. Mukova has won 7 of 8 games since leaving the court. Thoughts, anyone? And a lot of people were kind of putting views out there of that type, like not questioning the legitimacy of the medical timeout, but rather saying, are we comfortable with a situation where a medical timeout can swing a match like this? Well, I would say it is Ash Barty that swung a match like that. You have to cope better with that situation than Ash Barty did. It was one of the most staggering collapses I've ever seen.
And Ash Barty has said that. She has said, there is no way I should have let that become such a turning point. I'm experienced enough. I've played enough matches. I'm not doubting the legitimacy of the medical timeout. Yes, it threw me off my rhythm, but I should have been able to cope with it better. She is making absolutely no excuses. She just lost her game.
Could she explain it at all? Because no. If I'm in her shoes, I realise that's a stretch, everyone. That is going to play on my mind big time. The knowledge that it can just go and stay gone.
I made a similar point on air earlier today based on the fact that she'd had those losses to Alison Risk at Wimbledon when she'd been the best player in the draw to that point. The loss to Sofia Kenin last year. There have been one or two like that where you just, where's the game gone? What? Why isn't she able to influence this match anymore? Russell Fuller, who was sitting next to me, said, I think she gets a free pass for this one. She hasn't played for 11 months. She's not match tight. And if this carries on, if this happens again, then you would raise alarm bells. If this, you know, if this becomes a theme, but on this occasion, it's different. Because she's been the least prepared of all players, given that she's just come straight out of 11 months off.
I take that argument. I think there's a point there. I would say the as you say, David, the slight pattern emerging and the severity of it on this occasion mitigates that argument a bit. And I would also say that doesn't mean she gives herself a free pass in her own mind. And even if she does consciously, it doesn't mean her self-conscious gives her a free pass. How can that collapse not now feature in her psyche in future matches? It was a foundation shaking sequence of events.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the experience, I think, of watching Ash Barty. I said to you that it almost felt like she was letting it happen. And of course she isn't letting it happen. Internally, I'm sure she was raging at the errors she was making. And she was competing as hard as she can, I'm sure. It just doesn't look like that when you watch, because she's so contained, because she's so calm. And I think as a spectator, I found myself thinking, I would love to see a bit of external fight here from Ash Barty. You know, let a forehand rip, just get something out of your system or vent a little bit. But that is me projecting onto Ash Barty. She doesn't go about her business like that. And it works for her the way she approaches matches and plays matches. I agree there's a small pattern in some of these big matches where we've expected her to win. But I don't know. I think she's pretty in control and knows herself pretty well in terms of how to deal with these situations.
The other thing I would just point out is that Tsitsipas handled his deficit 6-3, 6-2 without ranting and raving and getting excited or getting upset, throwing a racket. He internalized and he worked his way. He persevered. And she needs to find ways in those situations to do that, persevere, get back in a match. I would have thought most likely it's just a case of keep continuing to put yourself in the position and to learn how to come out of those situations when they arise. And I don't think she could change or, you know, and I don't really think she should. I think it'll be an incremental learning experience. I do find her way of handling it quite interesting, the political manner in which she deals with questions in press conferences and very clearly decides she's not going to get involved. And I like the fact that she didn't try and throw Karolina Muchova under the bus, who was dizzy and not feeling well and had some treatment, you know. Maybe some people feel the rules should change and if you're not fit, you should just retire. That's a separate point. But I think that Barty, well, she wants to be able to wake up tomorrow and feel right, I think, and give herself, you know, a new day to just move on. Time will tell whether that is going to work for her. But I kind of think it will. I think she'll just keep having to put herself in this position.
I think what you're saying is that that loss has scarred me potentially more than it scarred Ash Barty.
I mean, I suspect it looks terribly jarring to you, and I'm sure if I watch you back, I'll feel the same. And look, it may end up being a recurring theme, but I think she is kind of world comfortable enough. You know, she puts tennis in perspective, I think, in a certain perspective that not everybody can. And I think she does that as a sort of self-defense mechanism. And I think that I kind of understand that. And I think that might end up long-term making her better.
If she sort of plays herself out of it and gets herself into those situations and builds up the muscle memory again, it is unclear how much she intends to play.
She did say she was going to set up camp in Europe, which
she did,
I found interesting.
Okay.
She said what her plan is, because obviously the issue she's had is she didn't want to play throughout all the lockdown periods, but what she said she's going to do is set up camp throughout the whole of the European season, and I think plans to play Middle East as well. But if she can set up camp with her team, she can go and play golf, she can have some downtime, but be in Europe for the clay, for Wimbledon, for the grass, and try to get a sense of normality that way whilst also playing these events. And I think that sounds like a really good compromise to me.
Well, that's great. That's really, really good to hear. It means, David, with all due respect to Karolina Muchova, that the jaw has opened up for Jennifer Brady.
It sure has. Very interesting match that was today. I mean, I didn't see the first set, but Pegula was seen to me to be knocking her off the court. And at the start, I think, of the second set, she was pushing her as well with these low, flat hits. I think Andrew mentioned this clearance over the net being very small compared to the loop on the strokes of Brady. But Brady's just her appetite for it. I mean, she was also clearly handling the hot weather better, so she outlasted Pegula. Because every time I looked at the screen, it seemed to be Pegula winning points, and yet the scoreline was going dramatically in Brady's favour in sets two and three. And she was just efficient. She's a relentless player because she's got reliable backhands and forehands.
Yeah, it was interesting because it came straight after Ash Barty's gone out of the tournament, which changed my whole outlook on that half of the draw. I think on reflection, naively, I had pretty much penciled Ash Barty all the way through to the final based on how well she was playing and who's left in that side of the draw. And it felt to me a little bit like maybe that was slightly playing on Brady and Pegula's mind at the start, especially Brady, perhaps. She didn't start very well. She looked a bit unsettled. But it was an interesting match, as you said, David. Both players like to take the initiative in the rallies. They just go about it in very different ways. Pegula with her flat hits, Brady with more spin. And Pegula was penetrating the court brilliantly in that first set, kind of knocking Brady off balance a little bit, rushing her. But gradually Brady took over, and I do think the heat and the conditions were a big factor in that. As you said, Pegula's serve started deserting her, and physically she didn't look as strong as Brady in the closing stages, who is definitely very, very fit and strong, Jennifer Brady. They've also got quite different demeanours. Jessica Pegula doesn't really give very much. She's very level-headed, whereas Brady will give you a little bit more emotion. And then a sweet moment at the end of the match where the umpire at the start had told them at the end, no hugging. And I thought at the time they sort of looked at each other as if to say, yeah, right. And then after the match, they did share a nice hug.
It was really warm, wasn't it?
Really warm.
They're properly good friends, those two. And by the way, I don't know Jennifer Brady at all. Never met her, never spoken to her. And she always comes across, she gives these really sort of straight-faced answers to interview questions. And I sort of think, oh, that she looks like a nightmare to interview, to be honest. But there were just two moments that really struck me when she came off the court. And obviously a huge moment for her having reached the semi-final. But you know how the cameraman or operator reverses down the corridor with the player in front of them so they can take pictures of them as they're walking towards the camera. And he's doing that. And then when he gets to the end of his run and she's about to go in the locker room, he goes, well done, Jen. And she goes, oh, thanks very much. And well done with the back pedaling, which was a really nice, funny moment, I thought. He laughed. And then also, she was congratulated by Su Wei Shea on Instagram. And Jennifer Brady was giddy about this in her press conference. She was absolutely chuffed to bits that Su Wei Shea had said nice things about her. And she's just raving about her and how lovely she thinks she is, you know. And I thought there's clearly more to this woman than we have seen so far. And I just really respect the way she has transformed her prospects as a tennis player in the last year. It's really night and day the way she's made herself into a physical force, and also her game is pretty formidable.
Mm. Backing up that US Open run at the very next hard court Grand Slam. Mm. You know, that's something Serena's done, Osaka's done. They were both in the US Open semis. They're now in the Australian Open semis. And Jennifer Brady has done.
Mm.
That is very, very impressive.
As Matt pointed out in our WhatsApp chat, this is the first time David G hasn't completely let you down.
Well, the funny thing is, because the first one was when I was backing her to do next to nothing, and she's overhyped. She's going to the semi-finals. Didn't she beat my player or something like that? I can't remember who it was. And then I picked her to win the French Open, and she loses in the first round to a 17-year-old, who, incidentally, was prodigious. It was Clara Towson, wasn't it?
I don't even remember her name.
The Danish youngster, Clara Towson.
It was Clara Towson.
And, it did strike me that the trajectory on the balls that Pegula was hitting and causing her problems with were the same types as Towson was hitting that day. And I thought this could go wrong for her. She did a really good job of, because I think she knew she's the favourite in the match. And suddenly, as you said, Catherine, Ash Barty's not there. I haven't got to face Naomi Osaka to get to a Grand Slam this time. I haven't got to face the world number one. I mean, with all due respect to Mukova, this is a real chance. But she conquered it.
For you and for Jen.
What a journey, well, David's
people
been on.
Copying me on texts, like tennis podcast listeners exchanging messages about what this would mean to me. I'm like, I don't even know the woman. But anyway, I'm really delighted for her. She's a really good player. And I like her.
I had forgotten that you'd picked her to win the French Open.
You'd actually picked her to win?
Maybe it was the final. I can't remember how far I'd gone.
I think you'd picked a Serena Brady final.
Probably, yeah. That didn't work out too well.
So it will be a Mukova Brady semi-final. One of those will be an Australian Open finalist to take on either Osaka or Serena. We'll have a minute or two to discuss that in a moment. Just to whiz you through some other notable events from day 10 in Melbourne. Dylan Alcott, he beat Sam Schroeder 6-1, 6-love in an hour and 3 minutes.
Wow.
To win his seventh consecutive AO quad singles title. It was a bit of a saga, this one, because obviously it was supposed to follow Nadal Tsitsipas, which ended up being a 4-hour-plus match. And it did eventually get moved to Yvonne Gudelgang Arena, the Dylan Alcott match. which means obviously it didn't get the primetime tennis coverage. And also a lot of people were critical of how late they moved it, how much waiting around there was. I mean, look, he always knew that match, those players always knew they were going to follow a potentially long match. So I think potentially it's quite harsh criticism. But anyway, 6-1, 6-love in an hour and 3 minutes. Extraordinary. Joachim Gerard beat Alfie Hewitt in the men's wheelchair singles final. That's his first ever Grand Slam in his third final. And he's the first Belgian to claim a Grand Slam wheelchair singles title. So that's a huge moment for Joachim Gerard.
Mm. And there was almost an epic comeback in that because he was, I think he was 6-love, 4-love up. And Alfie Hewitt got it back to, it went to the third set. So it was almost an incredible comeback.
He did admit that he was incredibly nervous and he felt like it was, you know, Hewitt as well, but him against his nerves to some extent out there. Obviously, huge moment for him. Big moment for me here because I've got to do some mouth gymnastics with my Dutch pronunciations here. A listener has written in to correct me on my pronunciation of the forthcoming name, and I'm really about to give it my best shot.
Go on, Catherine.
Given it a couple of practice runs, and this is the best I've got. Dieder de Groot.
Oh,
yes.
That was a different sound that came out of your mouth.
I wasn't expecting that, were you, Matt?
No.
That was amazing.
Beat Yui Kamiji.
Can you do it again?
No.
Only if you sing, Matt.
Exactly. In a very dramatic 2 hours, 20 minutes, women's wheelchair final. That is... Oh, God. That is de Groot's third Australian Open title and her ninth major overall. So that's pretty incredible. I'm going to move on from her very quickly, though.
Dutch listeners, how did she do? Marks out of 10.
Oh, well, whatever it is out of 10, it is, I've maxed out. Jamie Murray, Bruno Suarez are into the semi-final of the men's doubles, as are Rajiv Ram and Joe Salisbury. So that's a good day for the Brits.
They play each other, I think, in the semi-finals.
Yep. Yep, so guaranteed Brit in the final. And the women's doubles final will be Krejcikova and Siniaková, who are the third seeds, against Mertens and Sabalenka, who are the second seeds. So that's coming up. And other sort of straggly bits of tennis news. The Andreescu comeback continues. And she's doing it in classic Andreescu style. She's into the semi-finals of the Phillip Island Trophy.
Very good.
Thank you. It's her first semi-final since the 2019 US Open. She beat Arina Camelia Begu 6-3, 4-6, 7-6. So third set tiebreak. And she'll face Marie Bouchkova in the semi-finals. Sophia Kenin, she's had an appendectomy, an emergency appendectomy, which rather explains her very strange loss to Olivia Gadecki, the unranked player a few days ago. I mean, that's, yeah, our thoughts go out to Sophia Kenin having an emergency operation in a foreign country is not easy. I know it's, generally speaking, very straightforward surgery, but still, fingers crossed for her, and we really wish her well. And Andy Murray has pulled out of Biela 2. He reached the final of the Biela 1 Challenger last week. The Biela 2 Challenger is this week. He's pulled out of it. But it's not because of injury. He is still intending to play in Montpellier next week. So those of you that were going to be keenly glued to Biela for a second week, maybe you still will be.
Got a taste for it.
Yeah, if you've just been reeled in by everything that Biela has to offer. Now then, what about the day 11 order of play? It starts with mixed doubles on the Rod Laver Arena. Sam Stosur and Matt Ebden in action there, so an Aussie team. And that is followed by Naomi Osaka against Serena Williams. The absolute nightmare time of day for us and for European viewers. The the best time of day for American viewers, and I'm pleased for them, but it's suboptimal for us.
What time is it?
So that is not before 2 p.m. at local time. So that's 3 a.m. in the UK.
Works
up
for
with
me.
The Partridge.
That's fine by me. I'm ready.
Yeah, that is right in the David Law sweet spot.
Yeah. Bed for nine.
It's followed by Karolina Mukova against Jennifer Brady. Of course, they, as per usual, they play the women's semifinals all in the same day session. So one fewer day's rest for Mukova and Brady. Obviously, there is the slight sort of illness question mark over Mukova, so we'll see. But Brady would probably be the favourite in that regardless, I'd say. It certainly feels like hers to lose. And then the night session is Novak Djokovic against Aslan Karatsev, the lion that goes to toilet. What's happening there? What's happening in any of it?
Osaka, Brady and Djokovic.
Matt?
Agreed. Hang on, have you changed your mind, David?
I thought you were going for Serena, David.
Yeah, I did as well.
No, I got Osaka to win the title.
Now okay. That Nadal's gone.
No, I gave you my narrative potential possibility.
Right.
But I went pre-tournament, Osaka to reach the final. Brady, yep. Now that Barty's out, Brady will win and Djokovic will win.
I'm going to find someone that's predicting a Karatsev victory.
Come on then, Catherine.
There will be someone on Twitter. No, I'm going Osaka, Brady and Djokovic. Yeah, but who knows after today?
Well, yeah, I'm pumped.
Impossible
for all
is nothing, folks. Impossible is nothing. That's what we've learned from the Australian Open 2021. There'll be predictions in our newsletter. We've kind of given the game away about what we'll be saying, but people might be taking risks because there may or may not be quite significant ground to be made up.
Plus, we'll be picking sets.
And yeah, we'll be picking sets. So do subscribe to our newsletter if you haven't already. And if you have a pet, hello, for starters. And secondly, follow us on Instagram because we're going to be running a little story, a little competition, which is my big plan just to get people sending us pictures of their pets, which is sort of always my MO. We want to see your pictures of your pets watching the tennis. The more creative, the better. Paraphernalia is encouraged. Twiglets.
Podcast visibility.
Podcast merch and or sort of watching devices, listening devices. I do understand the medium of podcasting, listening device. that is all. Bonus points for all of that. We want you to post the pictures on Instagram, tagging at Tennis Podcast. We'll share the best of them in our stories.
Yeah, so you need to put them in your stories, Instagram stories.
Yeah, we don't want people, you know, ruining their lovely Instagram feeds for this competition. They can put it in their story.
Yeah, pop it in your story, tag at Tennis Podcast. We'll share the best of them and we will pick a winner. I say we, I'll pick a winner. And that winner will receive not only a Tennis Podcast pet bandana. Rosie has one. She has modelled it. She can confirm it's great. But also a currently not public available piece of exclusive Tennis Podcast merch.
Yeah. We're developing new lines, folks.
Developing new lines.
The winner of this competition will get the first one.
Yeah. Yeah. And you'll also get the joy of just cheering up my day with pictures of your pets. Billie Jean has started things off. She's showed us all how it's done, so that'll be on our stories to come. Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King. That'll never get old, saying that. My mascot is Zeus. He's lovely.
Mine's Rogue. Right, Rogue.
Mine is Scousel Mousel.
Hello, Scousel Mousel. Our Australian Open mascot is Crumble. Hello, Crumble.
Hi, Crumble. Hey,
Crumble. And Chris Albert Lee is our executive producer.
Right, Chris.
And our shout-outs are for Matt.
Kate Darling.
Oh. Simon Briggs has got to meet you.
Are you a relative of our former Chancellor, Alistair Darling?
Kate, magnificent name. Thank you for your support.
Magnificent name.
Ajay Nathan.
Oh,
Ajay.
A relative of Jiri Nathan?
The writer. Who
Great
knows?
Writer.
Well, Ajay, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ajay.
And finally, Carrie Flanagan.
Oh, hello.
I know Carrie Flanagan.
Do
I think
you?
Carrie Flanagan writes to us.
Does yeah, she? Does I she? Li- so. Is she staying in your house?
That's a bit niche.
Yeah.
If anybody
Do we need
hasn't
to explain
listened,
that reference?
If anybody hasn't listened.
It's the year anniversary of she's staying in my house.
Yeah, we had a shout out last year where somebody who does stay in my house from time to time as a friend of my wife and is somebody who comes to spend some time with us and as the family also happened to back us. And I didn't know she was coming out of the shout outs hat. And when Catherine said who it was, I said, oh, she's staying in my house. They didn't know that.
But Carrie Flanagan isn't currently.
No. Hello, Carrie. Thanks
but
so much for
your
support.
We do know and like her. Hello, yeah. Carrie. Thank you all for your support. Thank you for listening. Tell your friends. Leave us an iTunes review. Sign up to the newsletter because it's great. Follow us on Twitter. That's brilliant. And, I mean, you can follow us on Instagram, even if you don't have a pet. That's very welcome. But doubly encouraged if you have a pet and do enter the competition. And we'll be back tomorrow with day 11 of the Australian Open with crowds. Hooray.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.